Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to Teck Resources' Q3 earnings call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. This call is being recorded on Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Greg Waller, Vice President, Investor Relations and Strategic Analysis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks. Good morning, Mark. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for joining us for Teck's third quarter 2015 earnings results conference call. Before we begin, I'd like to draw your attention to the forward-looking information on slide two. This presentation does contain forward-looking statements regarding our business. However, various risks and uncertainties may cause actual results to vary. Teck does not assume the obligation to update any forward-looking statement. With that, I'd like to turn the call over to Don Lindsay, our President and CEO.
Thanks, Greg, and good morning, everyone. I'll begin with a brief overview, and then Ron Millos, our CFO, will provide additional color from a financial perspective. We will then close with a Q&A session where Ron and myself and additional members of our senior management team would be happy to answer any questions. The commodity cycle continues to provide a very challenging environment, but we are responding with lower costs, reduced capital spending, I would say excellent operating execution, and further moves to strengthen our balance sheet. Our ongoing focus on costs continues to achieve cost reductions across all of our business units, and of course, it is helped by lower oil prices. Our revenues are helped by the strong U.S. dollar as well. Our close attention to cost is reflected in steelmaking coal, where we had temporary production curtailments in the quarter, yet our costs were down and gross profit was up 5% versus the equivalent quarter last year. We also recently completed a silver stream agreement linked to Antamina and a gold stream agreement linked to Andacollo, which generated a total of around 1 billion Canadian dollars in cash. These deals are good examples of assets on our books with unrecognized value, and we have potential to do more on that front if need be. Overall, we are in a strong financial position to weather these market conditions. As of yesterday, our cash balance was approximately 1.8 billion dollars, including the receipt of the proceeds from the Antamina silver stream after quarter end. It is important to note that we currently have cash in excess of the approximately 1.5 billion dollars of CapEx remaining on our share of the Fort Hills project. Also reflecting changing market expectations for commodity prices, we have taken impairment charges of 2.9 billion dollars pre-tax on various assets in the quarter. Ron will speak to this in greater detail a little later. Finally, we were honored to be recognized once again for sustainability. Teck was recently named to the Dow Jones Sustainability World Index for the sixth straight year. Now, looking at an overview of our third quarter results on slide four, revenue of 2.1 billion dollars was 7% lower than in Q3 last year, and gross profit before depreciation was down 11% to 670 million dollars. Overall, profitability was negatively impacted by the asset impairment charges taken in the quarter. After removing unusual items, including the asset impairments, adjusted profit attributable to shareholders was down 130 million or 0.23 per share from the same period last year to a total of 29 million dollars or 0.05 per share. With that number, in fact, we exceeded market expectations for the quarter by a couple of cents per share. On slide five, and touching on some operational highlights for the third quarter, our operations performed well. Copper production was up by 10,000 tons, including record mill production at Antamina. Refined zinc production was also up due to a higher throughput at Trail, and coal production was down as expected given the temporary production curtailments. We also significantly reduced unit costs. On a U.S. dollar basis, coal unit costs are currently $64 per ton, and that's down $20 per ton or 24% from Q3 of last year. Copper cash unit costs are currently $1.44 per pound, down $0.20 per pound or 12% in the same period. This reflects the impact of our cost reduction program, but of course, also the weaker Canadian dollar and lower oil prices. I will now review our quarterly results by business unit, starting with the steelmaking coal business on slide six. As previously mentioned, we had three-week shutdowns during the quarter in response to market conditions. Production was 5.5 million tons. Sales were 6.2 million tons, in line with our guidance for the quarter. Ongoing oversupplied market conditions and indications of weakening demand in China continued to impact coal prices.
On a Canadian dollar basis, our average realized price was down only $3 per ton to $116. Revenue was down 10% to $719 million. We have significantly reduced unit costs, as I mentioned. On a Canadian dollar basis, site costs were down by $5 per ton, and transportation costs were down $2 per ton. Gross profit before depreciation and amortization was up 5% to $199 million, despite lower production and prices. I just want to point out again, our gross profit before depreciation and amortization was actually up 5% to $199 million, despite lower production and lower prices. Going forward, we will be producing at close to budget levels in Q4 to align our production to sales volume. Our operating plan for Q3 was successful in reducing the inventories throughout the supply chain, and we expect to earn positive cash margins at current prices and costs. And I would also note that we lowered our full-year guidance range for combined coal costs to $83 to $86 per ton. On slide 7, turning to our base metals businesses and starting with copper, production was up this quarter due to improvements at each of Highland Valley, Antamina, and Carmen de Andacollo. Production at QB was reduced due to the temporary shutdown related to ground movement near the SXEW plant. We restarted operations in August using only the south side of the plant while we continue to assess the full impact of the ground movement and implement remediation plans. We now expect full-year production of 38,000 tons of copper cathode at QB, which is a reduction of 10,000 tons from our original plan. And as I highlighted earlier, cash unit costs were down by 20 cents per pound on a U.S. dollar basis, which is consistent with our guidance for a significant reduction this year. And gross profit before depreciation and amortization was down 31% to $201 million. We expect full-year copper production for the copper division of 345 to 350,000 tons. During the quarter, we announced an agreement with Goldcorp to combine the Relincho and El Moral projects into Project Corridor. And this is a common-sense approach that allows us to consolidate infrastructure and to reduce capex and costs and to shrink the environmental footprint and to generate greater returns. In addition, we have successfully negotiated several labor agreements during the quarter. All three agreements at QB were successfully completed for two-year terms, and both agreements at Andacollo were successfully completed for four-year terms. Turning to slide 8 and looking at our zinc business unit, and please note that Antamina zinc-related results are reported in the copper business unit as zinc is considered to be a byproduct. So zinc concentrate sales were up this quarter, primarily due to the addition of Pondere sales with its restart earlier this year. Refined zinc sales were also higher, reflecting the good operating performance at Trail. And looking forward, we continue to expect Red Dog sales of contained zinc metal to be 200,000 tons in Q4. Zinc, lead, and silver prices all declined in the quarter, resulting in lower revenues. Overall, the gross profit before depreciation and amortization was flat at $270 million. Turning to an update on Fort Hills on slide 9, we are well into construction, and all critical milestones continue to be met. Engineering activities are approximately 94% complete, and construction is around 43% complete. Fabrication is now well underway with equipment arriving at site, and there are now roughly 4,800 construction workers on site, and the workforce will continue to ramp up to a peak in 2016. At year end, we will be only 18 months away from commissioning, and as of today, our share of the remaining capex is around $1.5 billion. Many of you had the opportunity to visit Suncor's base operations with us last month and could see for yourselves why we are so excited about the Fort Hills project, and we look forward to the completion of the project and the additional earnings and cash flow that we expect it to generate for a long time to come. And with that, I will turn it over to Ron for the financial highlights from the quarter.
Thanks, Don. I've summarized our changes in cash for the quarter on slide 10. Our cash flow from operations and working capital was $560 million. We spent $349 million on capital projects, including $218 million on Fort Hills, and capitalized stripping costs were $146 million in the quarter. We received proceeds of $327 million from sale of investments and other assets, including proceeds from the Andacollo gold stream that Don talked about earlier. The Antamina transaction closed in October. We also paid $201 million in interest and principal on our debt, and in addition, we paid $86 million in dividends. After these items, distributions to non-controlling interests, foreign exchange translation expenditures on financial investments and other assets, we ended the quarter with cash and short-term investments of approximately $1.5 billion. Subsequent to the end of the quarter, we received Canadian $790 million in proceeds from the Antamina silver stream, and we also paid the U.S. $300 million note due on October 1st out of cash, which is equivalent to about $400 million Canadian current exchange rates. And including these items, our current cash balance is approximately Canadian $1.8 billion as of yesterday. And as Don mentioned, we currently have more cash than the capital spending remaining for our share of the Fort Hills project. And based on current commodity prices and exchange rates, we now expect our year-end cash balance to be about $1.8 billion. And this, of course, assumes current commodity prices and Canadian-U.S. dollar exchange rate. We meet our 2015 guidance for production costs and capital spending, and also assumes that we maintain our existing U.S. debt levels and have no unusual transactions or events for the remainder of the year. Moving on to the next slide, our pricing adjustments. Lower prices resulted in $141 million of negative pricing adjustments this quarter compared with negative $28 million in the third quarter of last year. Copper was down 30 cents per pound from the end of the second quarter of this year, and zinc was down 14 cents per pound. These adjustments are included in our other in our income statement under other operating income and expenses. And the chart on the right represents the simplified relationship between the change in copper and zinc prices and the reporting settlement adjustments, and usually provides a good estimate of our pricing adjustments each quarter. Third quarter settlement adjustments were a little outside the typical range due to the larger volumes for most of the quarter and due to the pricing adjustments for silver and some of our other products. And as a reminder, refining and treatment charges and the Canadian US dollar exchange rate should be considered in your analysis of the impact of price changes in the adjustment, and you should also consider taxes and royalties when analyzing the impact on our profits. Turning to slide 12, as Don mentioned, we had $2.9 billion of asset impairment charges this quarter on a before-tax basis, which is about $2.2 billion on an after-tax basis. About two-thirds of the changes, or almost $2 billion, relates to our coal operations, but there were changes in each of our business units. We went through a robust and detailed process to determine the level of charges that, in our view, best reflects market conditions. We consider both internal and external information, use discounted cash flow approach to estimate the recoverable amount of our assets. This analysis is based on market view of short, medium, and long-term prices. Our key commodity price assumptions are based on current prices, and they gradually escalate to real long-term prices in 2020. We look at a range of sources to determine the best estimates of prices, including spot prices, forward prices, forecasts from analysts and consultants, and what other companies are using in transactions, plus our own views. And we've also factored in exchange rates, our mine plans, and our expected long-term cost structures. Ultimately, the appropriate carrying value is a management determination, but our auditors have to review this and ultimately agree that the impairment testing and the assumptions used are reasonable. And we've summarized some of the key assumptions in the table on the left side of the chart there, and further details are available in the profit and adjusted profit section on page 4, in the critical accounting estimates and judgment section on page 27, and in note 8 to the financial statements on page 56 of our news release. These page references might differ from those in the MarketWire version if any of you are looking at that particular release. Looking at our credit ratings on slide 13, since the end of the second quarter, our credit ratings were downgraded to non-investment grade by Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. DBRS typically reviews our ratings in the fourth quarter. You should note that there is no impact on our credit ratings beyond an increase in costs relating to both drawn and undrawn amounts. There are no restrictions on borrowing or additional covenants triggered under the credit facilities as a result of the downgrades. We still desire an investment-grade credit rating, and we believe that Teck generally has the attributes of a company that warrants an investment-grade credit rating in the long term. However, we appreciate that there may be times of cyclically low prices and or periods of high project spend when our credit metrics will be below our targets. And we are currently in such a period, and we're taking many steps to ensure our financial strength, and we will continue to do so. Turning to slide 14, we've received a lot of questions on our credit facilities over the past month or so, and on our public debt indenture. So we provided quite a bit of additional disclosure on these items in the financial position and liquidity section of our earnings release. And some of the key features are summarized on slide 14. We maintain two primary revolving committed credit facilities, which are available for general corporate purposes. Our U.S. $3 billion facility matures in July 2020 and has a letter of credit sub-limit of U.S. $1 billion. Our U.S. $1.2 billion facility matures in June of 2017, and it can be drawn fully for cash or for letters of credit. As previously noted, the credit rating downgrades result in slightly higher costs to maintain these facilities and higher borrowing rates if we were to draw on them. We also maintain a number of uncommitted bilateral credit facilities that total $1.5 billion for the issuance of letters of credit, primarily for future reclamation obligations. And we currently have $1.15 billion of these letters of credit issued under these facilities. And we do expect that we will have to put an additional $225 million in place by the end of 2015. All of our bank credit facilities are unsecured, and any borrowings rank pari passu with our outstanding public notes, and none of our notes or credit facilities are guaranteed by any of our subsidiaries. Our credit facilities contain a financial covenant require us to maintain our debt-to-debt plus equity ratio below 50%, and following the impairment charges taken in Q3, the debt repayment on October 1st and receipt of the cash from the Antamina silver stream in October, we are currently at 35%, well below the 50% covenant in these agreements. And there's also no requirement for us to maintain a particular credit rating. So on slide 15, I've addressed our potential requirements to post additional letters of credit as a consequence of the recent ratings actions. We are required to deliver up to U.S. $672 million of letters of credit pursuant to the Long-Term Power Purchase Agreement for QB2 and up to $425 million relating to pipeline and storage agreements for Fort Hills. However, we are currently in discussions with counterparties regarding deferral or reduction of the letters of credit requirements. Our intention is that if ultimately required, these additional letters of credit would be issued under the U.S. $1.2 billion committed facility. And you should also note that issued letters of credit do not constitute debt for the purpose of the debt plus equity covenant in our bank agreements and would not be required if and when we regain investment-grade credit ratings. Moving on to slide 16, our debt profile, with the repayment of the U.S. $300 million notes on October 1st, we have no substantial debt due until 2017, and further out, our average maturity is little under $600 million per year. And as I mentioned earlier, including the impairment charge taken in Q3, the debt repayment on October 1st, receipt of the Antamina silver streaming cash, our current debt plus equity ratio is 35%, well below the 50% covenant in our lending agreements. And our net debt to debt plus equity ratio is currently at 30%. So with that, I'll turn the call back over to Don.
Okay, thanks, Ron. And I think simply to wrap up, we're closely managing our cash, and we now expect to finish the year with around $1.8 billion, as Ron detailed earlier. So with that, we'd be happy to answer your questions, and I do want to note that some of our management team members are on the line in different locations, so there may be a brief pause after you ask your question while we sort out who's the best person to answer it. Okay, thanks. Operator, open for questions.
Thank you. Please press star 1 at this time for any questions. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. Please limit your inquiry to one question and a follow-up question. After that, if you have any further questions, please rejoin the queue. The first question is from Wilfredo Ortiz from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Just on the write-downs and the $75 WTI price that you're using for Fort Hills, I just wanted to get a sense as to, you know, the level of conservatism that you think you're taking relative to where spot prices are right now, and considering the discount, I guess, assumption that you're using relative to where I believe the discount is right now, relative to the forward curve. Or put another way, should prices remain at current levels, you know, how could, you know, you adjust this price and perhaps incent for further write-downs at Fort Hills?
We look at, you know, a range of different commodity prices for all the products, and you know, oil is one of them. We look at what market people are doing, what consensus is, what we think others are doing, and you know, of course, these write-downs are based on a substantial amount of judgment in the commodity prices, the exchange rate, and the various other factors that impact the ultimate netbacks that we get from the site. So, you know, we think that those are generally conservative numbers, but others can have different views on what that would be. The other thing you need to be, when we look at these write-downs, the accounting rules kind of require us to use roughly what a market participant would use, regardless of what our views are. So we need to be in that range, and we think we are. Certainly, if current prices stay where they are for a longer period of time, you know, we're required at the end of every quarter to look at impairments, but we would not expect that on a quarter-by-quarter basis there would be a substantial change in what our view on the longer-term prices would be.
Ron, I'd just like to add a comment on this market view aspect of it. This is Greg Waller, operator. The consensus view right now, when you look at the consensus summary of views provided by consulting firms, you know, the commodity analysts with the big banks that cover us, is $79 a barrel. And again, as Ron says, we have to use what market expectations are, and that's $79 a barrel. I also think is probably a reflection of when people are asked about long term, they're probably thinking 15, maybe 20 years. And keep in mind that this is a 50-year asset. And so we're using already a conservative number at 75 relative to the consensus view at 79. But again, they're probably not contemplating the 50-year term that we need to think about for the valuation of this asset.
Got it. And if I may follow up on another question, regarding the letter of credits, I know the intention is to use the $1.2 billion committed credit facilities. Is there a risk that at some point some cash could be restricted if market conditions deteriorate or you know, some of the ratios, you know, deteriorate rather than improve? I mean, is there a risk at any point in time that some part of the cash could be restricted?
Turn it over to Scott for that one, thanks. Scott's our treasurer.
At this stage, we don't see that as a risk. We'll have to evaluate circumstances as they develop, but not a present concern.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Orest Walkada from Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. A couple more questions just on your liquidity. Do you think you have more room for other potential streaming deals across the portfolio? And then just to follow on, just curious what your new rates will be on the credit lines if they are drawn now that you're no longer investment grade. Thank you.
I'll let Scott answer the second one first and then comment on your question after.
Sure. The drawn cost on our committed credit facilities would be LIBOR plus 2.25%.
Okay.
And on the potential for further streaming, the answer is yes, there is potential, but we are not looking at it at present because we're comfortable with the situation with having $1.8 billion cash currently, more than the amount required to finish Fort Hills, and a forecast of $1.8 billion of cash at year-end, at which time there's only 18 months to go until commissioning Fort Hills, so we feel comfortable and are not looking at further streaming at the moment.
Okay, but just so I'm clear in terms of optionality, do your North American, under your debt indentures, would you be allowed to stream out any of the North American assets?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Lucas Pipes from SBR. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody. To follow up on the streaming question, maybe could you expand on that and give us a little bit of a sense for what other asset sales could be on the table if you choose to do so?
Well, I think we've mentioned in previous times that you could look at several assets that have either silver or silver and gold, or there's all sorts of products we produce at Trail where you could create things. So I don't think there's really much more to say other than that. I want to repeat my statement. We are not looking at further streaming at this time.
That's helpful. Thank you. And then on Fort Hills, I remember you wanted to update the market at some point on the transportation options that you're pursuing. Could you give us an update at this point in time on where you stand and when we could maybe look forward to more details on that side of the project?
Hey, Rita.
Yes, thanks, Lucas. We are working hard to finalize our transportation and logistics arrangements beyond Hardisty. You will remember that we did announce with our partners on Fort Hills arrangements to both provide diluent to the site and blended bitumen service down to Hardisty to get us to that market hub in Alberta. And then we are looking beyond that, and we hope to put all those arrangements in place well ahead of Fort Hills startup in late 2017.
That's helpful. And if I may ask one final question on the cost side, obviously you've done a great job bringing down costs, specifically on the coal side. And I wondered, could you maybe give us a flavor on what else you could be looking at as we head into 2016?
Is that within coal or just across the board? Well, maybe I'll just answer both. Yeah, so we are intensely focused on further cost reductions. We've launched specific programs in coal at the moment, but watched closely by copper and zinc. And we've targeted finalization of some new plans to present to our board next month. So we believe we will be able to make further cost reductions, but we couldn't quantify it at this point what the amount would be.
Great. I appreciate it.
Work in progress, but certainly some interesting potential ideas and very good focus.
Great. Well, good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Greg Barnes from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Just approaching the carrying values of the coal assets from a different side rather than the price, what about costs? What kind of long-term costs have you assumed? Are they in line with where we are now and going up slightly, or how do you model that out in the carrying value calculation?
They're pretty much in line with where we're at now, and the teams are, you know, in this low price environment, the models are obviously being tweaked and how they would change the mine plans and everything in response to these low price, but they're generally in line with the current prices that we're at.
And you carry that out.
And Greg, I comment that the nature of your question highlights kind of what the nature of the impairment issue is, that a lot of it is iterative. If you assume low commodity price in the future, then you're likely to modify your mine plans. If you have higher prices, you'd have different sort of production profile. And you'll recall last quarter we were working on the mine plans and so chose to finish that job and to see if there were more data points on the market before making our decisions on that. And, we could look out two or three quarters from now and have a completely different situation in all of the things. So look for commodity price, exchange rate, cost profile, and the rest. So at the end of the day, we take our best judgment on it.
Okay. Just a second question on the zinc market. In the context of the large cuts announced by Glencore, that was surprisingly large in my view. I'm just wondering what your take is and why that level of cutback was required.
I'm going to let Andrew Tonkas answer that. this stage, not much surprises me.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Greg. With regard to their cuts, that they make it for their own reasons, and they didn't add much commentary other than the fact that they want to take the resource out of the ground at these valuations. So that's their own decision. But you have to remember that this is on top of the closures that are taking place at Century Mine, which the final concentrates are being delivered as we speak to the market. So on top of the Century closure and the Lachine Mine closure coming up to the end of the year, this just adds to the shortfall in concentrates that we're going to be seeing in the months ahead, and that will just cascade into the metal side. So it's unfolding as we thought in terms of the concentrate shortfall that's going to transpire over the next few months.
Yeah, the zinc price really hasn't done much.
Yeah, I think the zinc price will. The fundamentals are lining up. On the supply side, it's going to be a challenged situation on concentrate availability. We look at the Chinese imports, 60% of concentrates imports into China. Those concentrates will not be available to the marketplace with these closures, so that will have probably an impact on metal production out of China.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Oscar Cabrera from Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. I was wondering, just following up on Greg's question with regards to your coal assets, if you could give us a sense of if any of the reserves that you have reported at the end of 2014 were impaired with the changes in mine plan.
Could you repeat it? We didn't hear quite the end of the question, Oscar, if you could repeat it.
Yeah, sorry. My new phone set is just not great. Apologies. I'm just saying that with the new assumption in long-term met coal prices, were any of your reserves, because you had about a billion tons in reserves at the end of 2014, and with the change in mine plans, did any of those reserves become impaired, i.e. do you have a lower number?
We're in the process of finalizing that work. There may be changes between reserve and resource, but it's still preliminary at this stage, Oscar, to give a definitive answer on that. We don't anticipate that it's going to be substantive, but the work's ongoing.
Okay. And then with regards to your comments on cost containment, the grades in some of the copper assets like Highland Valley have been, this quarter was, or last quarter and this quarter were pretty high. So how sustainable is that, and how do you think that, what sort of expectation do you guys have in terms of mine plan going forward for Highland Valley in specific?
Dale Andrews with Lancer.
Yeah, thanks, Oscar. Yeah, we're very pleased with the performance of Highland Valley in the third quarter. It's unusually high grade. We don't expect those kind of grades to continue, although grade will be above reserve grade for the fourth quarter. As we head into next year, we are going to be coming towards the end of the high grade phase of phase 8 in the mine plan in the valley pit. So towards the end of the year next year, the grades will start to drop down significantly. But for the next four quarters, we should see above reserve grade. So in general, how that translates into costs, obviously that helped our costs in the third quarter. There are puts and takes depending on the different operations, but in general, we're quite confident in our cost guidance for the year, and we'll achieve that.
And just some further color, Oscar, on your original question on coal. We keep a certain tonnage in the reserve category, but we look at the business and the overall resource broadly defined, which is 5.9 billion tons. And the work that we're doing, which we would report at the end of the year, that nothing substantive would be changing in terms of the nature of the business related to adjustments to mine plan currently.
Okay, well, that's helpful, Don. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Kerry Smith from Haywood Securities. Please go ahead.
Morning. firstly, Ron, could you just remind me the CapEx left to spend at Fort Hills, the $1.5 billion, does that include the working capital for the ramp-up for the 12 months after you start up?
That's the construction cost, Kerry.
Okay, so that doesn't include the working capital. Okay. Okay. And can you hazard a guess as to what you think the working capital requirement might be?
Not at this stage.
Well, we'll have to get back to
you. We'll get back to you.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just on Ponderay, like, it's not making any money at the operating level at these prices, but obviously there are benefits to having that concentrate going to Trail. Is there a price that you think about possibly taking that 45,000 tons of zinc off the market? Or is there no price that makes sense to you? It makes more sense to ship it to Trail?
Well, we have shut it down before, so obviously there is a price. We are, I guess, in this low commodity price environment, reviewing all assets kind of constantly. That one's certainly on the list. No decision has been made, but you're quite right. It is a key source of concentrate for Trail for a number of reasons, transportation costs being just one. So unfortunately, at this stage, we couldn't say much more than that, but I think it's a valid question.
Okay. And then, Ron, just one last thing. You had talked previously about exiting this year with $1 billion cash. Now you're $1.8 billion cash, but that's after basically $1.3 billion of, call it, asset sales, if you want to count the streams. So the delta there is sort of $500 million difference to the negative. Is that all from price, or are there other?
It assumes the same debt level. At the beginning of the year when we put out the $1 billion, we assumed that we were going to refinance the $300 million note with the revolver. We've chosen to use cash to do that to basically save the fees on the banking agreements. And then the rest is the transactions that we've talked about and the various changes in costs, commodity prices, et cetera. The exchange rates also moved in our favor as well. So.
Right, okay. But the net effect of the lower prices and the favorable exchange is really that $500 million. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, okay. And then just maybe one last question just to follow up on Dale's comment about the grades at Highland Valley, which will come down by the end of next year. Are there any other significant changes that you could see in any of the mine plans at any of the other operations that might significantly affect your C1 cash costs, like at Antamina, say, or anything? I'm just wondering if, you know, the copper cost, the cash cost we've got now, this $1.45 a pound, is pretty good. I'm just wondering how sustainable that is, if there's maybe something in a mine plan that might impact that either positively or negatively next year, let's say.
Yeah, thanks for the follow-up. For Antamina, we anticipate costs and production to continue to be strong into next year. CDA, we don't anticipate any material changes from this year heading into next. I guess the one question mark, and we're currently working for the bonds, is the Quebrada Blanca mine. And we'll provide a further update at the end of the fourth quarter on that. But that's relatively small percentage of our current tons currently and heading into next year.
Okay, that's good. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you. The next question.
Just supplemental on the Ponderay question. The other aspect is that we're just sort of finishing the ramp up and getting to full production this quarter, and that will allow us to sort of come to view on what the real cost structure is at full production, which is a key factor in any decisions going forward. We are quite encouraged by the outlook for further reserves and resources in terms of a longer-term mine plan. So these are all things that are in the back of our mind.
Thank you. The next question is from Jeremy Sussman from Clarksons. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello there. Just, I guess, based on kind of where you see things now, can you give us a sense of kind of how you see, you know, maintenance CapEx, growth CapEx, and deferred stripping kind of, coming into play next year and how that compares to 2015 levels?
Okay, there's sort of three questions. We're going to start with Greg on this.
Well, yeah, Jeremy, we've had that question a lot recently. Really, all we can say at this point is we give our formal guidance in our Q4 report that comes out in February. But broadly, I think you can assume it'll be in the same order of magnitude as where we are now. As you look at where we are in the four major buckets of capital, sustaining capital, we've got down quite a bit. We think we can run in that range for a few years. In new growth projects, Fort Hills construction will peak next year. So right now we're running about $200 million a quarter. It'll be up a little bit higher from that next year. So let's say maybe $225 a quarter, so in the $900 range. So that pushes, you know, up a bit from the $850 guidance this year. Of course, we were at a higher share earlier this year. We've now stepped down to the 20%. So that's one of the reasons why we're only spending $200 million a quarter right now, roughly. And then on capitalized stripping, that will continue to be in the same level. So all in, we would expect to, again, you know, subject to giving our more formal guidance in February, but we would expect the number to be broadly similar to where we are right now.
Okay, that's very helpful. And maybe just switching gears on the coal front, are you seeing sort of any, you know, any signs of life, anything positive out there, you know, at this juncture, or is it sort of status quo and you're still kind of, we're all waiting for some of the high-cost production that seems to be a bit stickier than most of us would have thought to come offline. So I'll listen to what you have to say. Thank you very much.
We're all smiling around the table, but I think probably status quo is the answer. We were just waiting for the first question on coal. Rael Foley, go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. I guess to summarize it maybe off the top, there's been a lot of production cuts that have been announced and close to 50 million now, and about half of that has been implemented by our estimates. The thing, however, is that as those production cuts are happening, we're also seeing seaborne demand from China come down by very similar levels. So the two numbers are kind of happening at the same time, and that explains why prices are still under pressure. Now, when we look at a little bit closer at the numbers, you realize that U.S. is under a lot of pressure. I guess all suppliers are under pressure, but U.S. even more so. And if you look at the stats, U.S. exports annualized year-to-date at the end of August are down by 7 million tons compared to last year. We're just getting into negotiation for annual pricing in the U.S. as we speak, and we expect that pricing in the domestic market for 2016 will come down even further. So again, adding more pressure on suppliers, especially in the U.S., so that could lead to additional production cuts for 2016.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Garrett Nelson from BB&T Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Another question on the write-downs. The silver lining from an earnings perspective is that lower book value should equate to lower D&A, and it looks like your coal D&A was running at about $28 per ton year-to-date. Could you help us out with what D&A per ton we should be modeling from that segment going forward?
We might have to get back to you on that one, but overall, the company's D&A is going to be about $10 million a month lower because of the impairments.
$10 million a month?
Yeah, company-wide.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful. And then how are you thinking about the dividend at this point? Are you comfortable maintaining the 30 cents annualized level? Or has your thinking changed at all regarding whether it would be better to keep that $170 million or so of annual cash?
The dividend is always a board decision, and I think 9 of the last 10 years we reviewed that at the November board meeting, and so it'll be the same this year. The board will take a look at it in November.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. The next question is from Ralph Profiti from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for my question. Just have one, Don. There was an implied 700,000-ton draw on coal inventories in Q3. I'm just wondering, how is Teck positioned from an inventory standpoint into Q4 coal deliveries relative to previous years? I'm just trying to gauge how close we are from, say, weather factors or logistics issues becoming an issue into year-end. Thank you.
Okay, Rael Foley's going to ask that.
Thanks, Ralph. So, yeah, you're right. We have reduced inventory during the quarter, but we're in a position to meet all of our contractual commitments and committed sales going into Q4. So at this point, we don't see any major issues with meeting our commitments.
Thank you. Thank you. The next question is from Jeffrey McKinley from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I was just wanted to confirm a couple points on the LCs, if that's okay. The $1.15 billion dollar figure updated as of this quarter. Is that related to the $985 million and the $91 million that you had disclosed in the annual report that looked to be related to the uncommitted facilities, or is this a new figure?
Sorry, you were breaking up a little bit there, and I missed the first figure that you referred to.
Apologies. The $1.15 billion figure for this quarter?
Yep.
For the LCs related to the uncommitted $1.5 billion of credit facilities. Is that related to the $985 million and the $91 million as of calendar year end that was disclosed?
Yeah, those are all for basically outstanding reclamation commitments.
Okay.
And those amounts grow as you disturb more land, et cetera. So.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. Can you describe how these uncommitted facilities are negotiated from an extension standpoint, given the reference to generally having a one-year term? Is it reasonable to expect any changes in terms of size or terms of the facilities? And if so, would it be reasonable to expect the $1 billion sublimit on the 2020 credit facility to kind of be the backstop here?
John Wilson?
Sure. Thanks for the question. The uncommitted facilities, first of all, are distributed amongst about 10 of our relationship banks, including Export Development Canada, who's a very significant participant in all of this. And they are renewed and renegotiated every year. And we would expect to continue to be able to do that going into the future. To the extent that we need to increase these facilities, as Ron mentioned, the reclamation obligations generally grow a little bit each year, and so we've been adding a little bit to them as we go. And if we need more letter of credit capacity on our principal committed credit facilities, we would expect to be successful with the banks to increase those as well.
Okay, thank you. And lastly, in reference to the expectation for met coal prices staying under pressure next year, and kind of the market where it is today for both copper and zinc, can you talk about how you're thinking about the balance sheet as we move closer to 2017, given the upcoming maturities in 2017 through 19 in the $1.2 billion credit facility, and just how you would think about managing that when you would potentially start to address it and kind of where you think the capital structure could move to?
Scott, we'll start with that and we'll see what's left.
Sure. The $1.2 billion credit facility has a two-year maturity, and we would typically talk to the banks every year about a further extension of the tenor of those facilities. So next spring, I expect we would be talking with the lenders there to extend the term of that facility, should it be required. And we would also consider doing that on the main $3 billion facility as well.
Okay, and kind of understanding that the cash balance at year end is expected to effectively offset the Fort Hills spending over the next 2 years. and the potential changes to the credit facilities. And just kind of curious how you're thinking about managing the upcoming maturities beginning in 2017, given that you know, we're one quarter closer at this point, and this is under the assumption that certainly under the risk that the commodity prices don't rebound in the next, call it, 12 to 15 months.
Yeah, so I just want to highlight, just in case others on the phone aren't sure what you're referring to, the upcoming maturities are just $300 million in January 2017, and then another $300 million, I believe, in August of 2017. So not a material challenge, but Scott, over to you.
Sure, thanks. First and foremost, I guess we would look to refinance those maturities in the public debt market. That market would be a little bit challenging today, for sure, but possible. And assuming that those markets are available, that's probably what we do. If those markets were not available, our credit facilities are sized at this stage to be able to handle that refinancing.
And we would point out that Fort Hills is scheduled to be finished construction in the middle of 2017, sort of after just one of those $300 million maturities. So the cash profile of the company switches over from $850 million out, hopefully within the matter of months from that cash flow coming in. So quite a switch.
Thank you. That's helpful. And lastly, if I can, the negotiations around deferring the LCs, should we think about that kind of from, you know, a temporary deferral, or are you looking for more of a kind of a permanent restructuring of terms, or how should we think about that?
It's just, you know, we have to provide the counterparties with comfort that we're financially capable of managing our operation or our obligations to them, and we think that we can do that. But there are provisions in the agreement when we're non-investment grade that they have the ability to ask for some sort of security, which is LCs. So we think they'll be mindful, but they will generally be 1 year extensions, I would think. So if we are successful convincing them that we'll be able to honor our obligations, we'll get that for a year, and then we'll go back and do it the following year, and the following year, and the following year.
Okay.
Until we hopefully go back to investment grade.
Okay. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you. The next question is from Carl Blondin from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys. Thanks for taking the call. Just wanted to focus a little bit on the debt here. You mentioned that you would look for the 2017 maturities to refi in the debt markets if those are open to you. Any kind of thoughts of unsecured debt, or would you do secured debt as well if the rate is reasonable?
It's Scott again. Our preference would not be to have to issue secured debt. That would have implications for the unsecured holders. It is an alternative, and we have disclosed in the liquidity section of our news release the company's capacity to do that. But it wouldn't be our first choice.
Got it. Thanks. And then just a follow-up on the revolvers. I guess it's a two-part. How much would you be comfortable drawing on the revolver versus issuing secured debt? You mentioned if the public market's not open, you'd do the revolver. And then the second thing is, any restrictions on drawing on those revolvers in an unsecured fashion? So if you were to issue secured debt, would you need to secure the revolvers? Anything we should know about the restrictions and limitations there?
Scott again. No. If we were to issue secured debt, there would be no requirement to have to also secure the unsecured creditors, if you will, provided that we didn't exceed the secured limit basket, which is in the range of $3 billion.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
Okay.
The next question is from Matt Vittorioso from Barclays. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my questions. Just a couple quick modeling questions. Just want to make sure that we are reflecting the streaming agreements coming out of your EBITDA. So it looks like in the third quarter, you essentially zeroed out the gold ounces that are going to Royal Gold. Is that how you'll approach the Franco stream as well, that you will essentially reduce your byproduct revenue in the copper business by that silver stream?
John Gingell, our controller.
It's a fourth quarter transaction, and we are still under discussion as to how we'll do that. It will either reduce our costs or our revenue or add to our revenues. I'm unsure as to which way we'll go on that at this stage.
Okay, and can you comment on how much generally, say either on a quarterly or annual basis, either volume of silver or cash dollars are essentially going out to Franco? I think you've disclosed in the past that you, I think, produced about 12,000 ounces of silver at Antamina, I think 12 million ounces. Is that a good run rate going forward? How do we think about the cash going to Franco from that stream?
Andrew Golding.
Yeah, hi. Very simple terms, if you look at the 2014 production, Antamina produced 12 million ounces of silver. Our share is 22.5% of that. If you effectively model it as the loss of 95% of the silver revenue, then depending on what silver price you assume, you can easily calculate what silver revenue is foregone as a result of the stream. So 22% of 12 million was the figure in 2014. It varies a little bit from year to year going forward. That's a rough, reasonable approximation.
And 12 million ounces going forward is at least ballpark?
Yeah. And the thing to remember is that we retain an ongoing payment of 5% of the prevailing spot price of silver.
Yeah. One last modeling question for me. When you report zinc business unit revenue, say in the third quarter of $805 million, would it be possible to break that out between, you know, payable pounds of zinc that were sold, how much revenue was generated from actual zinc sales versus, say, lead and some of the other co-products? Do you guys have that by metal, the $805 million of zinc revenue by metal?
Greg Waller. Matt, I think the best thing to do on that is come to our modeling workshop coming up in Toronto on November 4th that we'll go through the details of how you take gross production and get that down to payable pounds. And this is for anybody who's listening, if you're interested in attending this modeling workshop, something we do every few years just to help people take our reported financial information, add it to the information that's generally available in the markets to understand and how to model the company going forward. And that's, again, November 4th in the afternoon in Toronto. If you're interested in attending, send us an email and we'll get an invite out to you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from Matt Farwell from Imperial Capital. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. Just a question on the coal production, 25 to 26 million tons. Do you have any flexibility to reduce production further than that with regard to the rail and port agreements that you have? Just looking at the sort of the all-in cost of the production, including the maintenance capex and production stripping, seems like the cost is higher than current spot prices. So is there any flexibility regarding those agreements?
Okay, I'm just checking. Ian Kilgar, are you on the line?
Yes, Tom.
Are you able to take that question? Did you hear it?
Yeah, for sure. Yes, Matt, we do have flexibility if we were going to alter our production, but at this point, as you said, our production is our sales are cash positive, so we intend to produce, as we said in the release, in alignment with our sales expectations.
Okay. And then, you know, you're talking about looking to refinance the unsecured notes. Have you also considered, I know this question comes up often, in addition to cutting the dividend, perhaps issuing equity as a means to lower your cost of capital?
Sorry,
Thank you. The next question is from Alexander Mack from FDA.
Sorry, operator, we haven't responded. We're just Don's going to respond.
Yeah, could you repeat the question, please?
Oh yeah, sure. This question has come up in the past, so and you did address the dividend and that board decision, and you're also discussing means of refinancing near-term maturities. Just looking at the cash numbers, seems like putting cash on the balance sheet might be a way of reducing your overall cost of debt if you were to come to the market with any kind of deal as suggested. So I'm wondering management's comments on that issue.
Okay, so I apologize, but I still don't understand the question. You're talking about us issuing more debt to put cash on the balance sheet? Issuing equity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely not. I think we've been very clear on this issue on each quarterly call. We have no plans to issue equity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Alexander Mack from FDA. Please go ahead.
Coming back on zinc, how is demand for zinc as a fertilizer developing in China and India?
Okay. I didn't come with the latest number on that, but certainly we got the formal recommendation from the Ministry of Agriculture, I think about a year and a half ago. There have been a lot of training programs disseminating the information to the farming community and many field agents from the ministry that are out educating the farmers. I think there are at least six companies now manufacturing fertilizer that contains 1% zinc, and so it is rolling out throughout China. We track actually the number of incremental tons that can be used as a result of the increase of its use in fertilizers. But we'll have to get back to you with that number because I didn't bring it with me this morning. But it's certainly a positive development, both from a consumption of zinc point of view, but more importantly, from a crop productivity point of view, because the results have been very exciting for each of rice and wheat and corn and so on. So that'll continue to roll out, but it'll take several crop cycles before it reaches its maximum.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, operator, we're going to cut questions now. We're at the top of the hour. If anybody's still in the on the call, on the backlog of calls, we're certainly happy to do a call with you later this morning or later today, your time. So let us know, and we can certainly get back to you. I'll just turn it over to Don at this point for some closing comments.
Okay, just a couple of comments, I guess, offering some perspective. A lot of the questions today were fairly short-term in nature. As we understand, people are trying to update their models, and as Greg said, we do have the modeling workshop coming, and that'll be helpful for that. And also there are sort of different kind of what-if questions that are kind of based on the overall question of what if the cycle is dead and commodity prices sort of stay at spot levels forever. I'd point out that when we deal with large institutions such as banks and other companies and that are involved in long-term investments, whether they be in infrastructure or mining or other commodities, that they don't believe that the cycle has disappeared, and they fully recognize that there are down cycles and up cycles. And so I think that's important context. I would point out that we have a competent, battle-tested team that is systematically working our way through what are, for at least some commodities, the worst market conditions in almost everyone on the phone's lifetime. And you could look up the prices in real terms and relative to cost curves, and you'll see what I mean. But I'd also remind you that the best and most effective cure for low commodity prices is and always has been low commodity prices. And remember that the darker the winter is, the brighter the spring will be. So thank you very much for listening today, and we look forward to talking to you at 1 o'clock now.
Thank you. The conference call has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for participating.